Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So if Washington is hopelessly partisan, you can see it in the parties, not just the Democratic and Republican parties, but the cocktail parties and the dinner parties. In a new Vanity Fair article, journalist Maureen Orth writes about the Washington party scene yesterday and today, and why today's parties aren't as fun or as good for America as the parties of old. Maureen Orth is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair and author of the 2004 book, The Importance of Being Famous, Behind the Scenes of the Celebrity Industrial Complex. Maureen, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you.
So why should we care about the social scene in Washington, D.C.? Does this affect us?
Sometimes it can affect policy to a great extent. If people can get together in a social atmosphere and get to know one another as human beings as opposed to just people that they're going to oppose in a bill or in diplomatic negotiations, I think it's much healthier for people to perceive one another as fellow human beings first and not just opponents.
And you write that the party scene is reflective of the political climate in Washington. How do you see that today reflected?
Well, what's happened is that things are very, very changed. Obviously, it used to be in the era of Camelot or whatever, there was a kinder, gentler, smaller place. It was also a more exclusive place. But what's happened now is that there are no longer the pool of women available to dedicate themselves to becoming hostesses and putting people together, because of course we all have careers. Lobbyists, to a great extent, have taken over a tremendous amount of influence. It costs so much money today to be elected that people are out fundraising all the time, and money underlies everything. What has also happened is that there's so much technology that there didn't used to be. People can take cell phone pictures of people when they're going to the bathroom, literally, now, and that happens sometimes to famous people in Washington. And bloggers sort of patrol the base very zealously. They don't want people compromising, and therefore, and you've got cable television, and so people go do sound bites. Yeah. Congress meets at night now. All their votes are at night.
They're so there's available. A reluctance to even go to parties where people from the other side might be attending?
Excuse me, I didn't hear the beginning.
So there's a reluctance to even go to parties now?
Well, I don't think there's a reluctance so much as that there's not even that many opportunities.
Yeah.
I think that people are thrilled. For example, there's maybe the Kennedy Center Honors are coming up on Sunday night. That's one place in the year that everybody comes together and seems to have a wonderful time. But there aren't too many occasions.
Of course, I don't know which is worse. Gridlock to the point where people on the two sides can't even socialize with each other as human beings, as you say, or the idea that the top Democratic leaders and the top Republican leaders are really buddy-buddy behind the scenes and that there's this elite power structure.
Well, I wouldn't there's no chance that's the truth these days.
But from the past, I mean.
No. I think what you have to, you can look at it a different way, which is if you really want to get a bill out on Social Security, if you want to get education dealt with, immigration dealt with, you've got to stop screaming at each other and sit down and work out a bill. And I think in years past, people would respect one another and their differences, and they would, but they would know how to be able to hammer something out. We live in a democracy, and that's the way we do things. You have to do it with both sides. You just can't, quote, scream at one another and go for the sound bite and go for the camera. And you can see the gridlock that's occurring.
You quote Sally Quinn, who has thrown a party or two in her day, as saying that the death of the Washington Post's Katharine Graham was the beginning of the end of bipartisan entertaining. Did she bring people together despite the fact that she was disliked by some in Washington?
I think the fact that she was the owner of the major newspaper gave her a tremendous amount of power, and she herself was a person who was very conscious of trying to get to know people and understand people. So it was, I think, it was considered at that time, it was always nobody turned down an invitation from her because you never knew who you might meet there.
Did that even go on during the Watergate era when, of course, the Washington Post was leading the charge?
It's interesting that even during Watergate, obviously at one point I think that Nixon, before that time, things got pretty, I think, hairy then. But people in Congress certainly still socialized with one another. I'm not sure if all the White House people got together. I wasn't there at the time.
You wrote that during the Clinton administration, peace was partly brokered in Northern Ireland through movie nights.
It was basically, there was a big night, actually there was always a big St. Patrick's Day party where both sides were invited. And so you would have Ian Paisley and Gerry Adams in the same room, which is utterly unthinkable to anyone in Northern Ireland. And so they would be invited, and neither side wanted the other to get one up, so they'd all show up. And I remember one night when I believe John Hume and Gerry Adams and someone, they all sang a song together, which was just considered amazing. And it really was kind of a breakthrough of sorts to get people to start seeing one another as human beings.
So maybe Bill Clinton could resurrect the party scene if it becomes First Lady.
Well, actually, what the Clintons did mostly is what people said to me in the article, because, you know, the article is a series of quotes from different people who have been very involved in this scene. And basically, what people told me in the article was that the Clintons really converted so much of what was generally just social life into fundraising and really used it as real estate to fundraise.
Maureen Orth, my guest on WNYC. Her article in Vanity Fair is called When Washington Was Fun. So when was Washington fun?
Well, I think there are people today who still think there's times when Washington is fun. I'm not saying it's never fun anymore, but I think I was quoting people who had lived through the Jackie Kennedy era when these incredible Nobel Prize winners and artists were all gathered at the White House, and there was just one dinner after another, and people were at the highest level of culture and politics were mingling, and journalists somehow, I guess, got in on it at certain points, and everybody just thought there was a lot of excitement. There was a sense of possibility. There was a thought that maybe things could change for the better, and they might be part of it.
You name Jimmy Carter's name as someone who contributed to the death of the bipartisan social scene.
Well, when he came into office, he actually, if you look at it now, I remember I quote in the piece that he went on television and told everybody to turn their thermostats down and to wear sweaters, and people just were horrified at that. And he didn't serve liquor in the White House, and he was very sort of austere. And so I think that kind of lavish entertaining was frowned upon under him. But, of course, when Reagan came into office, it was quite the opposite, because Nancy Reagan had a lot of social friends, from very rich friends from Beverly Hills and New York, and they wanted a party, 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 and they did.
So let's see, which one of the two had the conservative Christian values?
That's for you to figure out.
You write about Jackie Kennedy. Let me go back to this. Mm-hmm. The quintessential first lady to many people as Washington hostess, and she regularly invited artists and great thinkers to the White House.
Right.
Who comprises the majority of the guest lists these days?
Well, the guest list these days, if you compare, I interviewed Letitia Baldrige, who was Jackie Kennedy's social secretary, and the criteria was, who are the doers? Who are making the place go? And you know, the Bushes have had very, very few state dinners. They've only had 5 and 7 years in office. And the last one for the Queen of England was very heavily weighted towards fundraisers for George Bush's library. Excuse me.
Maureen Orth, my guest on WNYC, her article in Vanity Fair, When Washington Was Fun, about the demise of the bipartisan party scene. And, of course, it's holiday party time right now. And she says this even reflects badly on policy in America today. You're there? You okay, Maureen?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So go ahead. I think you were in the middle of a thought about the majority of the guest list today.
Well, I think at the White House, for example, now George Bush is starting to think about his legacy. Then there are very, very few slots at these state dinners. For example, the most you can kind of fit in is about 130 people. And so, for example, when the Clintons wanted to do a lot of fundraising, they just stuck big tents out out of the back and had many, many more people. Anyway, but for the Bushes, they had a state dinner for Queen Elizabeth, and then they had a dinner for President Sarkozy of France just the other day.
Right.
And basically, I think somebody, there was one paper that wrote that there were, I don't know how many, but he's freighting it now for fundraisers for his presidential library, because the legacy now has to be funded, and that is funded usually with these great big, huge, very expensive libraries, and that's what people come for. And if you recall, the Clintons had people come sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, big donors, and it was just then the sort of the preciousness of what the history is then just becomes something else for the highest bidder.
Do lobbyists go to these parties a lot?
Which parties are we talking
about?
Well,
whatever Washington parties.
Well, yes, I think that lobbyists now, there are so many fundraisers day in and day out for people, for members of Congress. They just are constantly fundraising to try to, you know, think of the next election. And so lobbyists are the ones who are the people who have the money. And I interviewed one lobbyist who told me, you know, we just have terrible fatigue over this. It's just every time we turn around, we're being asked to donate. And people actually say, is there a party now where you don't have to write a check? Most people think that if you go to a big party now, it's either for a cause or it's for a candidate, and it's just expected that you are going to have to write a check if you go to a party.
So if it's Lobbyist City, maybe a year and a day from now, Trent Lott is going to be the new it person.
He got caught out, I think, obviously, because he obviously wants to resign before the new laws kick in, that he would not be able to lobby quite so quickly.
And embassies are a part of the party circuit in Washington. So if parties are being used as fundraisers, what's the effect of this on foreign policy?
What happens is that embassies are not allowed to contribute, and what has happened is that the embassies have seen a demise in their influence, and they're not able to get the kind of guests to come to their parties since they're not going to get any money for it, or if the White House really is sort of in a bunker mentality, as the Bush White House has become mostly since the Iraq War, then they don't have people that they can honor. It's harder to get powerful or interesting people to come, and therefore they don't have the same influence that they once had on the party scene.
And in your article, you mentioned the Kuwaiti ambassador's wife as a Washington hostess. How does she use the party scene?
Well, she's very, very, she's always out there working very, very, very hard, and she just basically entertains and entertains and entertains, and she has been successful in getting people of both parties to, or at least some members of the administration and the White House, to come to some parties. So she is right now the one who is trying the hardest.
You're a journalist. Is the party scene useful for journalists other than gossip columnists?
Absolutely. I think that people are willing to talk because the rules have gotten so much stricter, and it's so much harder to gain access maybe than it once was, simply just because of the press of all the other business, that if journalists can have a word with a newsmaker without a bunch of aides being around, and just to the point where he could say or she could say, can I call you tomorrow about this? I'd really like to talk to you about such and such. And you just even to gain access, it's a very good way to do it.
So you and your husband, Tim Russert, use the party circuit to cultivate sources? It's part of the job description?
I wish I could get him to go out and party a little bit more, but not really too much. No.
What does he do? Stay home and watch the Buffalo Bills every night?
Yeah, that's about it. And also the Boston College Eagles.
Yeah, they play a little more often. Let's see. Well, we just have 30 seconds. Any quick story about how maybe you've used the party circuit as a journalist?
I'm trying. Well, no, but I began the whole piece with an anecdote that happened to me on my very first trip to Washington when I was in college, and I met Bobby Kennedy, and how exciting and much fun it was. And I don't think that any young person coming from California for her first trip to Washington would ever dream to be able to do that today.
All
maybe
right. We have to leave it there. Maureen Orth, special correspondent for Vanity Fair, her article called When Washington Was Fun. It's been fun to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.